Well, the mid-60s was a fabulous time for you. You were having lots of fun and lots of success.
It was, I think, a good time for the automobile industry in the whole. Everything was going our way that time. Mm-hmm. And we had a little bit of a tendency, I'm afraid, not to even look elsewhere. Mm-hmm. I think maybe design staff did maybe more than anybody, because Bill was always very careful to make sure that his chiefs and his people got to the European automobile shows.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Just dedicated to that, so that it would rub off on you.
Mm-hmm.
And as a young person, going to a European auto show was just unbelievable.
It must have been.
It was so thrilling. And you were like a sponge. You just absorbed every little thing that was different. You know, you just absorbed all that. Probably got thousands of dollars more out of everybody went over there than they ever even thought they got.
Right.
As if you're a car lover, you really... let's see, we're talking about the 60s.
You're at the Inter-European Auto Show.
Yeah, oh yeah. The idea of doing that was really great. And the other thing that Bill did is he made sure that there was an interchange of designers between Opel and Vauxhall and the United States. And they would learn a lot coming over here, working with our designers, and by the same token, learned a lot going over there.
Mm-hmm.
So that usually two people at least each year would exchange.
Mm-hmm.
And I was the first time they did it, we went to Vauxhall, it was 1960.
Mm-hmm.
And I was the designer, there was an engineer, a clay modeler, and an interior designer. And the four of us went over there, and it was the first time we'd ever had that interchange.
This is your British affiliate.
Our British affiliate.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And it was just terrific. It was just so exciting and so beautiful. When I came back, I encouraged Bill that this was really the way to go,
mm-hmm.
to broaden our designers. And that was fine. That same thing now, the same thing applied to Opel Styling over there. We were sensing that the design wasn't that great coming out of there.
Mm-hmm.
And we really decided we got to have top-notch people over there.
Had you had German nationals mostly working there at that time?
Yeah, and we had a couple people over there, but it wasn't until we really put our heads to it, so we've got to get top people.
Mm-hmm.
And word of mouth gets around, and the people find out, they know, hey, you know that he is, we've heard he is the top man, the guy, mm-hmm. you know. Mm-hmm. So then the Germans respect you more for your ability, and you respect them when you jolly well do soon learn to respect the Germans for their engineering ability, and you see how methodically they put an automobile together and test it, and it's a work of art. So I would say that was probably the most the period where I gained the most knowledge was when I worked at Opel.
Mm-hmm.
And of course you're a one-man show there, you know, you're really running everything, and that's the first time you attend board of directors meetings, and the first time that you handle the press almost exclusively yourself, and you keep your books for your organization. It is in a mini scale, mm-hmm. similar to Irv's job.
Uh-huh.
It really is.
Mm-hmm.
And it's much less difficult. Because you don't have so many divisions that you have to work with, and different personalities and all that. You've got one group of engineers, manufacturing, design, and that work together,
mm-hmm.
and they're all pretty damn good. And if you just do your job well, you're going to get a product out of it at the end. But I really like that over there. We travel a lot.
Mm.
I don't want to take off in there too long. So I used to take these three-day weekends or something, you know, the Neckermans are sort of a travel thing. Scoot off to Turkey or or Morocco or all these places on a 3-day weekend, because if we journey, we're right smack in the middle of all this thing. We went to Russia.
Mm-hmm.
But that was fun. I really enjoyed that. My kids enjoyed that too. They were over there and they were spent their high school days in a international school. Kids from 40 different nations were there.
Mm-hmm.
They're taught by the head of the school, an English headmaster, and ran that school. You know. And so that was a overall just a fabulous experience that I would not have had if I hadn't been working for GM design staff, you know, and so it really was great.
What was your specific mission? Did you have a chat with
Yes, they're doing the world
over?
Car.
Pardon?
The little world car that was the Opel Cadet, it was the Chevette that was made here and all.
Yeah, so that was your...
That was the assignment. And Pete Estes asked me, when he was made in charge of overseas,
yes.
He asked Bill if I could come over there and do that.
And Bill was willing to let you go for it.
Bill thought that was very important. Thing. Now, Bill wouldn't do it if he didn't want to.
Mm-hmm.
He would not demand you go over there if you don't want to.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't.
You
want
could refuse it.
You could refuse it.
Yeah.
And a few had refused it.
Uh-huh.
But I guess he felt that you had to really want to do that, or you wouldn't do a good job. So,
and interestingly, you accepted it enthusiastically and regarded it as a challenge, rather than a lateral transfer or whatever. Yeah.
I had some mixed emotions. I thought, what can Opel be? Here I'm designing for Chevrolet, the largest amount of more cars than anything else in the world, but it's so much different because you do get into all the complex of the situation, the manufacturing and the engineering, I think, much more so than you do.
Was Opel at that time affiliated with the Vauxhall unit?
No, they're entirely separate units. However, they had just started working on a program where they shared some stuff.
Right.
It was very unsuccessful.
Oh, really?
And I don't think either of them were trying very hard.
Mm-hmm.
Eventually, it got to the point where Vauxhalls were really badged Opels.
Yeah.
All the engineering structure, but that's when Vauxhall started being more successful again. Also, their warranties went down.
Uh-huh.
They physically did tool up Opel components in England.
Mm-hmm. Tell us a bit about the Opel Cadet, how that emerged, how it was planned, and
we had started that here a little bit in one of the studios to look at what that was going to be. And Bill really could care less about that car. And he knew it was important. He knew it had to be done, but it was like tailoring a dwarf, he says. Oh, God, tailoring a dwarf.
Sounds like it.
And we got the four models out in the courtyard, and he said, yeah, it's all right, but God, I hope I'm never so poor I got to drive one. So, you know, Bill was a high-style car guy, period,
right.
And that work had to get done, but he sure as hell didn't want to dirty his fingers on it.
He knew that the European taste needed a much smaller car.
Oh, yeah, sure. But I'll never forget when we sized our 77s and 78s down, you know, the first time we
right.
did that.
Yeah.
And they were all out in the patio, and everybody is patting each other in the back, told how good we all are. And Bill says, you're all crazy. He says, it's like after World War II, when you come back and the Hershey bars half the size and twice the money.
So that was quite a success. Any particular reason why it was such a success, the Opel Cadet?
It was a car that was... universally, it was used all over the world, in Brazil and Australia and South Africa and America. It was changed here as far as the front face and all that
right.
stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody here really wanted to do that car.
Really?
It's just that it had to be done fast
mm-hmm.
and had to meet the weight targets and all that stuff, and he knew that car did, so he just rammed it down their throats, Pete did.
What was it succeeding? What had been the previous?
There was another little Opal Cadet before that.
That's what I thought, yeah.
One before that.
But nothing...
In fact, the first Opal Cadet was the 1936 Opal Cadet that the Russians
really?
Took the dyes back and made the Moscovich.
Really?
Right after World War
they
II.
They stole them.
Well, I think they were given.
Given to them.
Yeah. But, they took those dyes and the Moscovich ran around for a decade after that. It was an Opal Cadet with a different badge on it.
It wasn't very exciting.
Oh, no.
No.
Well, I don't think the cadet that I worked on there was very exciting either. It was incredible restraints on manufacturing techniques and money. And the previous car was supposed to be working on was supposed to be a cadet, and it got over the cost and weights, and had to be marketed between a cadet and an Opal Record as a new name.
I see.
And they were so gun-shy over the cost and weights of that car that this time they said, I think Pete's words were, if that job doesn't come through, it isn't one fenning more or 1 kilogram more expensive, you better start walking west till your hat floats. So there was very definitely a restraint on that car.
Yeah.
And we did the best we could. Car is still running the road today, as a Chevette, and we're still selling.
Very successful.
But it wasn't the fun thing. The fun thing was the Manta Coupe, that second generation Manta Coupe that I worked on. I loved that car.
Tell us a bit about that.
The first generation Manta was a very successful car, too.
How do you spell that?
M-A-N-T-A, like a Monterey.
Monterey, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Very successful car, too. It was one that Chuck did, and probably the first high style car to come out of Opal.
Mm-hmm.
And the new one, we knew from that one what we wanted to do to make this one last a long time, be a successful coupe too, and it turned out to be, it's still running over there. They still have that rear wheel drive coupe.
Mm-hmm. Your bread and butter, right?
Yeah, so that's very good. The other thing that was a lot of fun was to get involved with this car for Eric Bitter, called the Bitter car.
How do you spell that?
B-I-T-T-E-R.
Was this a special?
This was a special car that was made at the beginning at Intermeccanica in Italy.
Mm-hmm.
It used Opal Diplomat, which is a modified V8, Chevrolet V8 engine, mm-hmm. 5.4 liter, a DDOM rear suspension, and in this case, only automatic transmission. And those parts were sent down to Italy, and this body was put on it. We designed this body, went from scale model directly into a full-size wood mock-up.
Mm-hmm.
And we had to get it done in about 30 days in order to utilize the timing at this particular shop in Stuttgart, where the guy was going to have to let his men go in between jobs.
Mm-hmm.
So if we could ram this thing in there in that time frame, he could get his tooling done for virtually 20% of what it would have cost ordinarily.
Mm-hmm. Merschley was?
Hmm?
Merschley, did you say?
No, it was, I've got to back up. I'm going ahead of myself. Eric Bitter talked Opal into using their components on a car made in Italy called the Indra.
I-N-D-R-A.
I-N-D-R-A. And that was designed by Scagliati down there in Italy, and it used, at one time, Ford, and now Opel components were used in it. That car was a beautiful car, but terrible car as far as quality is concerned. This little shop just turned out junk as far as quality. You used to pay the guy per car.
Mm.
The craftsman so much per car. Well, the guy would just go at it like mad, you know.
Right, piece work.
Yeah. So we decided we'd get a good body, we'd get it designed and built in Germany at Carrozzeria Bauer in Stuttgart. Fine outfit. And that's when we did this 30-day car, and then these things started to go out of there. I think it turned out about, maybe 500 cars or something like that.
What was the occasion for this, or the reason for it?
Oh, the reason is Eric just loved the, making these custom cars, and I think he wanted to get his name on a car.
Bittner, was he well known?
Bittner, Eric Bittner. No, he had been a racing driver for Opel before this. Knew a lot of people at Opel. Terribly, a very, very enterprising young guy. And he came to us to do the design, and he said, the ground rules on this thing are, I don't want anything that looks like an Opel, and I want it to have a little smell of spaghetti. If we're going to lean towards something Italian.
Yeah, the Italian touch.
So with the ground rules, that's what we came up with. Mm-hmm. And it was a genuine four-seater.
Ah.
It had seats in the back. Pretty fairly tight headroom, but it did have rear seats.
What year was that?
Well, see, that came out around 1973, I guess.
Pretty radical design for that.
It's sort of, I call that design kind of a timeless design.
Yeah, right. Uh-huh.
It was.
The wedge front end. And
yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the neat slope to the back.
There are a few cars like the Maserati the Ghibli at all that fall into that category. I think they're timeless. You know,
you're right. Yeah. What happened to that? You say 500 cars were made.
Yeah, that we did. But then what happened is that we stopped making that old Opel Diplomat and came out with this new Opel Senator.
Oh.
Now, that car had a fuel-injected 3-liter six automatic as well as 5-speed transmissions and different rear suspension. So all the stuff in this thing was now obsolete.
Uh-huh.
So Eric had... Now, by about this time, I'm gone.
Oh, you had, huh?
Well, about the time that came out, I was designing on that car,
right,
but
okay,
I wasn't...
Yeah.
There when it came out.
Mm-hmm. It's gorgeous.
So Henry Haga and the guys there did some work, and they did a new notchback coupe design, very fast notchback coupe. And it they're selling those today, and they're making those things partially up in Schwalm where he has his factory, and all the various details on the new one I don't know, but I know he's selling them here in America. He gets them specced for America, and sells a lot of them in areas like Beverly Hills, places where
status cars.
Well, yeah, where Mercedes, you get almost bored looking at Mercedes and Rolls, you know.
Want something different.
And they want anything that's a little different, you know, and then that kind of car fits into that atmosphere very nicely, thank you, you know.
But still affiliated with Opel at that time.
Oh, yes, yeah. Oh, yes, all Opel.
Still a full GM subsidiary.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Must be an exciting time for you there, too.
Oh, yeah, it's super.
Your family loved the atmosphere of Germany,
they really
Central Europe.
Yeah, my wife and kids all spoke excellent German, mine was poor. the meetings were all conducted in English, and you couldn't gamble on making a mistake.
Mm-hmm.
So I had, you know, I had a tendency to speak, since everything was all business conducted in English, I had a tendency to not really have the demands that, say, the wife had when she was just shopping all the time.
Oh,
and
yes.
So usually the wives picked it up faster than the husbands did.
They protective tolerance.
Yeah, right,
yeah.
Right. I learned how to drive past a police car at 100 miles an hour without my foot flinching.
The old Autobahn, that's
what you
say.
Believe me, you can't do that for, it takes a few months to not have your foot lift off the accelerator when you're going fast like that and see a cop car.
I'd be the first to believe you.
But you go by, and if it's a really nice car, the police will just go, that's nice.
What a great feeling.
Yeah. It truly, you truly can drive 100 miles, 100, 120 miles an hour on the way to work.
Just incredible.
And it's the only place where they say, how long does it take to drive to Munich? They say, what kind of car are you driving? Which is the truth. It could be a good half hour difference one way or the other. I don't know if they'll ever put a speed limit on those roads. They say that it hurts the German technology and the the way that we make these fine cars are as a result of the cars being subjected to that type of driving. If we didn't have it there, the quality of our car would be down. I don't know if I agree with any of that.
Well, you and Pete had a pretty good success over there, you and Mr. Estes.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it was terrific.
The World Car became a reality. Pretty much.
Yes, it did. And that did fairly well right from the start. And on very little investment, that was the design was used all over the world. Mm-hmm. And it turned out very well. It should have been changed long before over here, you know.
Really?
It was a car designed in 1969, and mm-hmm. and here it's 1984.
They're still using it.
Five, and we were using that thing, you know.
That's incredible. Incredible compliment to
the product
you turned down.
I really don't tell a lot of people that was involved with that car because it looks so stuffy and old now. That but those were interesting times. When I came back here.
What year was that?
Well, I came back in 1975. And they were doing all this size down stuff.
Who's the architect of that here?
Well, that was really everybody had to do it. We had to get the weights down, the sizes down, the frontal area down, the whole thing.
Well, it was sort of dictated from the external conditions, but you know, if you remember Ford, they didn't do it.
No. The architect was Pete Estes.
Yeah, okay, fine. Yeah.
And he actually set a schedule down that was the most demanding schedule, and nobody broke it. He says, you will introduce it with a Seville. In other words, the size down Cadillac will be the most expensive Cadillac, and it will be set a new mood for a smaller size car.
Mm-hmm.
Very calculated thing. Mm-hmm.
So it was pretty much his plan, huh?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then, so we get the big cars, which are our bulk of our, that was a big move to take and not work up to the big cars, but to take the big cars and size them down. And then, you know, and you worry if the people were going to like them. And, you know, they really didn't like them at the very beginning, but they got used to them so fast and the fuel prices were so high that all of a sudden they looked so right and all the ones that didn't size down looked so like elephants.
Exactly.
So it was the right move to make.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them looked a little awkward to me when I came back, but as they were in the process, because I had very little to do with those 77s, 78s. It was the matter of drawing the line to the end of the piece of paper there, you know, and then go out and just fill it in the corners and they just look like boxes.
Right, yeah. But it worked.
It worked. I do think, though, that it was one of the more awkward phases we went through.
It must have been, yeah.
This was going out of Europe at the same time, the same size.
Uh-huh.
And that, to me, was one hell of a lot better looking than those.
Mm-hmm.
That particular era of automobiles over
right,
here.
Exactly.
So you say our finest hour, I sure as hell wouldn't say that.
You were talking a moment ago about the Opel Senator.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Is this still pretty much a, have they kept the general configuration?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
yeah, it has new sheet metal.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Right. Yeah.
But the basic car is still going on. Got a new model coming out. They make a lot of cars at Opel.
They've expanded since you were there?
They've added the small car, the little S car, mm-hmm. which they call the Corsa. It's been added since
Corsa,
I was
yes, I've heard about that. How's that doing?
Very well.
Mm-hmm.
Very well. It's a case of restraints of how many they can make in that particular plant. They make it in Spain.
Oh, do they?
Yeah.
Before we leave Opel, was there a sharing of nameplate with a Japanese concern?
Yeah, Isuzu. Isuzu.
Yeah.
That was the strangest merchandising I ever saw in my life. Opel, Buick, Opel by Isuzu.
Right, exactly.
That is the strangest thing. They talked the Japanese into using that particular body for the next car. And they decided they weren't going to import any more opals into this country because, let me see if I got this straight now, because the profit on each car, the sale price they had to get out of compared to the profit made on, wasn't good enough. So they decided they're making the same car over in Isuzu's, and their profit level's higher, mm-hmm. So why not bring those in?
Great idea.
Oh, great idea, except that you got an Opel made by Isuzu for Buick.
Marketed by Buick, yeah.
So that was you know, impossible. Poorly handled.
Well, it lasted a few years.
Yeah, poorly.
So does Pete come back to the, Pete Estes come back to the United States and in a sense bring you with him?
Yes, Pete came back before I came back.
Mm-hmm.
He got his new assignment just before, because I remember Rube Jensen came over as head of overseas, and I was shortly after that. I went back home.
Mm-hmm.
But no, he now when he left overseas, I still stayed there open we figured out we were going to have this 4 year.
Tenure
over there.
Right.
And incidentally, we were the only people overseas that knew that. When an engineer or somebody else, somebody in sales would go overseas, he didn't know if he was going to work there for a month or the rest of his life. And they always were jealous that the styling guys
mm-hmm.
knew exactly how long they were going to be there.
Uh-huh.
And then will be taken back.
Isn't it strange they never told anyone?
No, it really is a really an unusual thing, and I was always very thankful for that. Even if you enjoy yourself, it's still a strange, it's hard to plan your life and your children's lives.
Mm-hmm.
Are you going to be, are they going to be raised and educated in America or here or something? So I was always very thankful for Design Staff setting up that thing that way.
Was that Mitchell's doing?
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure.
He wanted you to be secure and... feel that you hadn't been abandoned by the home.
Yeah,
the home
yeah. And also, he didn't want you to get too secure over there.
That's true. A neat concept.
Yeah.
So you were glad to get back?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I was. Even though I enjoyed it, I was glad to get back. You sort of make a decision whether you want to be an overseas person the rest of your life, because a lot of those people, their whole lives are spent in overseas duty.
Mm-hmm.
And it's okay, but it becomes a little bit shallow, Dave, because what happens is you the minute you get to know somebody closely, they get transferred, removed. And so it's very difficult to make more permanent type of friendships because you're a little gun shy
mm-hmm.
to ever get to know somebody too well because you're going to get moved or they're going to get moved or anything. So it all has a little bit of a cocktail party
mm-hmm.
Atmosphere.
An air of impermanency.
Yeah, an air of impermanency. I think that sums it up. So, which is can still be fine and exciting for a while, but with the idea of when I said when I was ready to come back, I was ready to come back. Mm-hmm. It was just fine.
And how did you get the call? What kind of... in other words, what did they say? Well, you're coming back to do something different.
Oh, no, Bill would talk to you regularly about that.
Oh, good.
Oh, yeah, no. When you
exactly
came back here, yeah, no. Now, how much longer are you going to be there? You're going to finish out this job and come back when?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I thought about June, mm-hmm. such and such. Or I have to be back by September to get the kids in school. Sorry. But no, we were in touch on and talked about that. So never told you what you were going to do when you came back.
Ah, that's what I meant. Yeah.
That drive you crazy, too.
I can imagine. You didn't know what he had in mind for you.
No.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure he did either.
Ah.
He just going to find something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But that was a little disquieting at times. Mm-hmm. But I came back and ran an experimental studio area. We called it experimental at that time. The same as advanced.
Yeah.
Two words you could use either way.
How had that sprung up? You talked about Bill Mitchell's Sandbox. Had that grown out of that? Or was it more?
We had always had experimental studios where we did work. Under Bill, we had created a few more, because there were always some interesting things we could be doing.
The Motorama helped a lot, didn't it?
Well, this even goes beyond that. Those Motorama cars were done right in the car studios.
Were they? Oh,
yeah,
I see.
They
okay.
were, Dave, yeah. They were,
yeah,
they were not done necessarily in experimental studios. Ones like the Firebird were.
Yeah, right.
But the divisional cars were done.
Yours were being done for internal consumption, more or less.
Uh-huh.
Your experimental cars, yeah.
For internal?
As concept cars.
Yeah.
To draw from.
Yeah. We were just trying to do the wildest things we could do.
That's it, yeah. Right.
You know, and really, frankly, we did realize that we were being robbed. I mean, these things that were on those cars were starting to appear on
uh-huh.
other cars and other places.
They were pretty much under wraps, weren't they?
Well, the experimental cars were kept under wraps, but the ones that were at the Autorama were not, and we were learning that a lot of our secrets were being taken from us on those cars. But anyway, the experimental studios and the divisional studios were really worlds apart. And when I went in there, there was an atmosphere of anything that that goes on down there is a $3 bill. Isn't worth a damn to a production man.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And to an advanced guy down there, we were doing all the seeking out and the really high roller stuff, and
creative
the stuff that's going out in the production studio is just ordinary as hell. And yet the production rooms had many more privileges. Went to many more things in advanced area, but the very nature of going with the division to the Chicago show or the Proving Grounds or whatever it might be. So that was a very unusual atmosphere when I took over those advanced studios, and I really wanted to change that.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't want them to back up completely. I wanted to, when they did a car, there's an expression that I wanted them to sneak up far enough off of first base that they're ahead of the game,
mm-hmm.
but not so far that when it went into production you couldn't get back on it and still not lose your design.
Mm-hmm.
So whereas some of these things that we've been doing in the past that hadn't had the respect of the guys upstairs were way up here.
Mm-hmm.
So I was dedicated to that purpose, and I'd get the guys in the production room to try to come down. I'd invite them down to see what was going on. And I think I raised the level of the advanced studios while I was there to something better than it was.
Mm-hmm.
You don't ever 100% solve those kind of problems.
But you kept the creative edge that you
Yeah, we wanted that. Yeah. And we inaugurated an aerodynamics studio that solely works on aerodynamics.
Really? What year was that?
Oh, golly, Dave. This is really it's a hard one to say.
Quite an innovation at that time.
Yeah, it's about 7 or 8 years ago or something.
Uh-huh.
But anyway, and I felt that was a very important thing, and especially since we had this wind tunnel here, we better be doing state-of-the-art work in aerodynamics.
You're lucky to have that right close by.
Yes, we damn near didn't have it, because when the gas crunch came, that was one of the first things they were going to throw out.
You know, that happened at Ford.
You know it happened at Ford.
Yeah.
And which is the worst thing in the world to throw out, because that's the very thing that's going to give you the edge on that. And fortunately, some of the guys could have lost their jobs, but somebody saved the big prop, or they saved a bunch of the stuff, they hid them away. And so when we did get going again, it was...
It's located right here in the tech center.
Yeah, it's just right behind this building.
Mm-hmm.
It's run by the engineering group, but it's right adjacent, 10 feet from the Stalin building,
Good.
And the tunnel goes underneath it. So
Good. You can wheel the cars over there.
Yeah, yeah. Right. Mm-hmm. Which is I feel strongly about that we work properly with that and still get good things, and various people feel more strongly about it than others.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it's an ongoing battle.
Mm-hmm.
that probably always will be. But I just can't imagine doing a car that doesn't have a fairly good drag coefficient in the late 80s. It just, you're negligent. Mm-hmm. It's part of the portfolio of a good designer to be able to handle these things. And even aesthetically, I think that if it isn't good, it's going to be associated with things that are out of date. Mm-hmm. It may look good now to you, but in that time frame, it's going to go old. Mm-hmm. And it isn't cheating that win right. Somehow you know it. And also, in addition to that, Irv wanted me to handle the commercial vehicle studio again. Ooh. So we have one studio that does the big trucks and one that does the bands and things like that. And so we've done some new programs, new pickup truck and new van and some heavy duty truck work, the module heavy duty stuff, which is very exciting. An area that I had not worked on before. Mm-hmm. So just this fall, when the position opened up here, Irv wanted me to be in charge of North American Automobile, but this time exterior and interior.
Mm.
So that you could really coordinate things. Now, this has never been done quite like that. If you look at that new record, you'll notice where the guy that was in charge of interiors is now running the exterior, the advanced design area,
mm-hmm.
interior and exterior, and the guy that was working in the truck area is now, interiors is heading up the truck area.
Uh-huh.
So those two areas that I was involved with, now these chaps are involved with.
Good. I'm interested in moving you back just a bit to the era when you were sort of, said, okay, you're going to do advanced. The average production cars. Did you find this a bit disquieting? You've indicated some of your feelings, but could you expand on that a bit? In terms of your previous work as a designer?
Yes, I did find it disquieting. I didn't consider it as important as the production work. Although, this is deep in my heart.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But I knew it was important to be done. And around this building, Dave, you're a soldier.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And you're given an order, you do the order.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the only variation to that was that overseas thing.
Uh-huh. We had a little.
They said, you don't want to go overseas, we don't want you to go. Okay. But other than that, that's the end of that crap, because you're told to do something, you do it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the way we operate. Well, then you say, okay, I'm going to be doing the advance work. So then you take up your pencils and you go to work and say, we're going to do the best damn advanced stuff that you ever seen in your life.
Did you think that Mitchell had some idea that he wanted to upgrade the work of the advanced studio, the thinking, the creativity?
I think he wanted to upgrade everything constantly in every area. Yeah, I'm sure of that. He was never really satisfied. You know, there's always something that could have been done better. He always loved something wild going on down
there.
Yeah. What do you got, kid? What do you got down there?
Yeah.
Show me. So, and anything that he would always encourage you when you were onto something that was really new and sensitive.
So, what was the concept of the advanced studio at the Mid-Sound Museum? What marching orders did you have? Not specifically, but generally. What type of?
Well, I was given certain assignments. One assignment was to work with the engineering staff. They were doing a new car that was supposed to get 100 miles per gallon and do all this stuff and everything. We worked with them on that car. I initiated myself a little personal luxury car that mm-hmm. wasn't anything like the stuff that I was seeing going on.
Mm-hmm.
These squared off looking things.
Mm-hmm.
We started this aerodynamic studio.
Mm-hmm.
And we did a couple theme cars from that that were shown all over the country.
What were they, do you remember?
Aero X and the Aero 2000 and the one that's down at Epcot, that little guy.
Ah, is that the 2000?
Yeah.
That's gorgeous.
Those were aerodynamic study cars.
And then
Roger Smith thought, God, it's a knockout for Epcot, let's put it down there.
And, and that's where it is.
Yeah.
On loan?
No, it's permanent.
Permanent?
Yeah. Well, it's permanent as long as a display like that's permanent. I don't know. We'll be down there changing that again sometime, Dave.
Oh,
you know, you know.
Oh, it's your display. Well, it's not theirs.
Yeah. Wait, no. It's the corporation's display.
That's
the ride was done by Disney.
Yeah.
And as the ride ends up, you end up in a you know, kind of an atmosphere of a studio of the future and the Dreamers Workshop, I think they call it.
Marvelous.
And most of the things in that area came from the advanced area of design staff. We worked on projects like the lean machine, this thing that leans over when it drives along. You've probably seen pictures of that. Really, there were quite exciting projects, especially when you got running vehicles out of them.
Mm-hmm. None of these prototypes are.
Yeah.
That's good. Have you kept a lot of them?
Oh God, they end up in museums and things like that. I the little lean machines out at the Chicago Scientific Museum and another one's out in L.A. It's kind of sad endings, you know, for things like that. With that you really wanted to see go into production, you know.
How would that work? You would come up with a concept car.
Well, let me hear it. I know what I think. I know what you're driving at, and I can give you a good story on that. We started the Firebird Camaro, the one that's on the road today, this brand new one. We started that in one of my advanced studios, and the theme car was the Firebird. Mm-hmm. We're not doing the Camaro at the time; we're doing the Firebird with the hidden lights. And what a fight that was to get those hidden lights.
What was that?
$50.
Oh, I see. It's cost.
Yeah.
Not aesthetics.
No.
Yeah,
okay. But that we found a design that it's been thrown out earlier.
Really?
And that I was reviewing all the work the studio had done, and I says, "My God Almighty, that's a hard one to beat. That is really good. How did it get thrown out?" Well, it was just that day. And so I went up by this time Irv's running the store.
Ah.
Bill had retired.
Bill had retired.
Yeah. And Irv, I tell him, I says, "Now listen, I can't argue over my own painting. I probably sell my own painting.
Mm-hmm.
But I went through the books and I saw something that's still over in the warehouse that was done in Bill Porter's studio that to me is the most beautiful Firebird. It's better than anything we're working on down there." He says, "What is it?" I showed him the picture. He says, "God, that does look good, doesn't it?" I says, "Where did that model? The guys didn't destroy it. It's over in a warehouse."
Was that Bill Porter, you say?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. "I want to bring it back."
Mm-hmm.
He says, "Go ahead, do it."
I
don't know. So we took it back, brought it back. Chuck and Irv came down and says, "Shit, it's a knockout. How do we ever throw that out?"
Mm-hmm.
And we just went to work on it. And then that design, they nursed the Firebird. It went up to the production studio, which is always a tough thing for an advanced guy to cut the cord.
How so?
Oh, somebody else is going to finish your car.
Oh, of course, okay.
See?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Unfortunately, the attitude was right and everything when it went up, and the attitude was right with Chuck and Irv because they weren't going to mess with that design. That was a good design.
Yeah.
So that was a good example. The other one was the Fiero. We did all the Fiero in advanced studio.
Really? Yeah.
Working with this new body process thing with this wild guy, Hoki Aldercotti.
What was his name?
Hoki Aldercotti is the mad Turk. He's one of the greatest engineers we've got in this corporation.
You know how to spell his name?
Oh, no, I can't spell it.
Okay, okay.
But he was great fun to work with.
He's still here?
Oh, yes. Yeah. Oh, sure.
Yeah.
We really enjoyed working with him. And, it was a fun project. Cause we never knew if he was going to be able to sell it. Are there too many two-passenger cars? We've already got a Corvette. These stories, you know.
Yeah.
But we knew there was a market for that low-priced little two-passenger car that was kind of in and midship engine and all that stuff.
Right.
And,
yeah.
And for once, we were going to beat the Japanese. Well, it got delayed a year, and this happens. Oh, we're never going to. I'm reading articles about the Japanese going to come in, but Honda's going to have one, and Toyota's going to have one. They'll beat us. But that's one car we got out there, got it out before anybody used to the draw.
I'd be able to.
I think we can really be proud of that car. Mm-hmm. It has its own character.
Mm-hmm. That was from scratch, too.
Yeah, it was from parts on the shelf though.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
It was a blank check for your design, mm-hmm. but it was no blank check for components because you had to take things that you had already tooled up.
It's always a bit of a problem, isn't it?
Yeah, it's limiting, but once you know where you got to be, it all makes good sense, and you just go at it and do it.
The body and component engineers wouldn't let you come up with new. All new.
Oh, we couldn't afford it, or we couldn't justify it for return on investment, and mm-hmm. and the cost of the car would have gone up, and the timing on developing those components would have gone higher. Mm-hmm. So it just told you the sensible way to do this car, if we're ever going to get it, mm-hmm. and get it on time, is to do that. Because you don't really know what's underneath it. Mm-hmm. Once it's there and running. And
those were two incredible success stories that came out of your shop.
Yeah, they were wonderful stories, you know. But see, now that got the level of the advanced studios even higher. Mm-hmm.
That's really what they were for, mm-hmm. were they not, or the concept.
Mm-hmm. So now that I'm running the production studios, I'm dedicated to make sure that those guys down there are properly utilized.
That's good. That's good. Yeah. The Jazzy Chevrolet sport car come from the
Z28.
How'd that come out?
That is the Firebird.
Oh, I see. Okay, right.
With different front end sheet metal and rear deck taillights.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's the same great, door.
Great model.
Yeah, that's every bit as nice. It just has a different character.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Jerry Palmer's group does that. He has the Corvettes and the Camaros and that type of car, sporty cars.
The new Corvette, what was the genesis of that very radical change?
That was done all in Chevrolet studio, and I was an opposing team.
Really?
That. Yes.
That's interesting.
Yeah. No, I was fighting for a midship engine Corvette. So Chevrolet engineering wanted a front engine rear drive car. Mm-hmm. From the word go, they wanted that.
A particular reason why?
Oh, I think they liked the characteristics of that front engine rear drive characteristics as far as handling is concerned.
Mm-hmm.
They felt there was a little more room for luggage and things in a front engine rear drive car.
Mm-hmm. Right.
They knew just what they wanted to do with that. And they had planned that from the beginning. I felt that, and a number of people here felt that you're not in the new league. If you're going to be selling a car for $25,000, you better be like a 308 Ferrari, not mm-hmm. an old front engine rear wheel drive car.
Right.
So I was working in opposition to Chevrolet at that time in my role of advanced design.
Mm-hmm.
And there's one I lost.
Uh-huh. But you're not unhappy about it, are you? Are you?
Oh, no, the car is a fine car. I personally like the new aesthetic looks of a 308 Ferrari better than I do the new Corvette.
Yeah.
That's a very personal thing.
Mm-hmm.
And if I didn't have my heart on it, I shouldn't have been working on that rear engine one, mid-engine one. So.
Did you have any feeling, as some Corvette purists do, that... there'd been a betrayal of the old Corvette tradition.
With what? With the mid?
With the new Corvette.
No, I didn't think so because the mid-engine Corvette four-rotor show car
mm-hmm.
was very well accepted, very much liked by the Corvette.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now I think you must make a Corvette for the lover of those cars. It's got to have a Corvette. Nastiness to it.
Mm-hmm, right.
It's got to be fiberglass.
Yeah.
And would you believe that we took a clinic with Corvette owners, and 98% that they wanted it on fiberglass, not sheet metal. They evidently felt that, that a lot of them got in their Corvettes used Corvette, and the body didn't rust. They learned their favorite shop where they got their fiberglass repair stuff done. Mm-hmm. All the Corvettes came in there and talked right. to their buddies, and they all talked about how much they love the fiberglass. And we, of course, can tool cars so much more reasonably in fiberglass than sheet metal dies. So, monetarily, with the amount we build, that's a good way to go. Mm-hmm. But it's what the people, they want. It's what they want.
That's right. So, had there been some thinking that they would switch to sheet metal, switch back to sheet metal?
Well, there was talk of it.
Was there?
Yeah. Yeah. Uh-huh. Until we found out, then there's never been any more talk about that.
Well, you in recent years you are now responsible for all the North American production cars, which moved you back into the mainstream, so mm-hmm. to speak. Yeah. And I suppose I would like to know, and I think our research audience would like to know in the next 10 or 15 minutes, how you feel General Motors has impinged on modern automotive design, starting with the 80s, and what it will do in the 90s, and what you see ahead for the 90s.
Well, I think General Motors has always been a leader in design, and I think will continue to be. I think that you're going to find here in this country that people are taking a decidedly different tack on automobile design, and I find it delightful mm-hmm. that one isn't copying the other. The Ford look is not like the General Motors look
no.
now. And I'm not saying which I like better, or mm-hmm. use about, but it is not. It's their own individual look. General Motors cars are getting a kind of an individual look. In fact, we have to be very careful. We don't get too much of that. They
right.
look too much like that.
Yeah.
We're always fighting that when you put five divisions in one car. That's
right.
that's something. We're the only corporation in the world that does that.
Right.
And the Chrysler itself is starting to get a little bit. This new laser sedan is
mm-hmm, right.
kind of a unique,
mm-hmm.
And I find it delightful, because if we ever lose a sale to another company, I want it to be an American company, not a Japanese company. So I find it depressing when we or our competition don't come out with something superb.
Mm-hmm.
It's heartbreaking to me, more so than ever, because these other guys, we have to be careful. We have to, this country has to make a terrific product now
mm-hmm.
to compete with the Japanese.
Yeah.
And I think that I still believe we're more innovative.
Mm-hmm.
The Japanese are doing an excellent job of execution now.
Mm-hmm.
They're doing a fine job of putting a car together, executing the surfaces better than they ever did. The detailing is better.
Mm-hmm.
But I see very little that's innovative.
It's sort of reached a plateau, I think.
I don't know whether they have or not. You never can tell.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't see the innovation that I see in the products in America and in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
I'm always interested in seeing the European products, because they're some areas they're very stuffy and old-fashioned, but some areas they just do such a sensational job. It's fun to watch. I love to see the Audi come out with all flush glass.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Beautiful, beautiful job they've done that. That's what I see in the future. I see cars being more clean, more flush, less bright metal, more of a one shape to it, in a shape that's an efficient,
mm-hmm.
fuel-cheating
mm-hmm.
shape. And I see more individual cars coming in the future, more of that era in the 60s,
mm-hmm.
where we made individual body styles, more Fieras, more different things like that.
Good.
And I think the public will find that refreshing, too.
Did you have a feeling of constraint imposed on you in the early, working toward the 80s? A slower pace than perhaps Ford was having to take because of their economic position.
Restraint?
In terms of
slow pace?
No, in terms of forward movement in design. more of an evolutionary approach rather than a jump?
The early 70s, of course, were the culmination of those large big
right.
cars.
Exactly.
The late 70s were the start of all this downsizing.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
And it was incredibly demanding periods of time for these releases that took place in a short period of time. And
right.
And all these new models that were coming out and couldn't be delayed for any time period whatsoever. So it was a time where we worked very, very hard.
Mm-hmm.
Long hours
oh, yes.
to get all those cars out on time. And something always goes wrong.
Was there?
Well, you know, something didn't work and you got to go back and do that again and re-release it. And so you have to count on that.
You spoke of an aerodynamics section in your advanced studio. Was there a feeling that you weren't moving as fast in the aerodynamic sector that you might want to?
Oh, yes. Oh,
that's what I meant by
that. Oh, it was incredible, Dave. I personally didn't feel that we had enough people on the ball team
mm-hmm.
that really cared. And that realized the importance of this.
Yeah.
That was my personal struggle.
Mm-hmm.
Now there were some people that were always with it and understood it and everything, but not enough.
Mm-hmm.
And now every designer's worked with it. Everybody is familiar with it. Some more than others, but they're all. It's part of their portfolio. It's part of their cars. And there is a little bit of a competition amongst themselves a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Which is delightful. I'd
mm-hmm.
like to see that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think our management is all much more concerned about that.
A little more progressive
yes.
than they have been in the
yeah.
past, yeah. That's good. In terms of design for the next couple of decades, what do you see into the 90s and into the 21st century? What sort of general configurations do you see for General Motors? And perhaps for the industry as a whole.
If I could tell you what was going to be in the year 2000, I would do it right now, and I'd do it for 1990.
Mm-hmm.
And nobody can, Dave.
Really?
If you've ever looked at the Smithsonian Institute, had a marvelous display that went to six cities, I think. Unfortunately, Detroit was not one.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a collection of the stuff that people thought was going to be the future. It's called Yesterday's Tomorrows. Have you heard of that?
I think I saw the catalog.
Yesterday's Tomorrows.
Yeah.
And if you ever look at that stuff, nothing ever happened.
Mm-hmm.
What happened wasn't anything like what was being proposed.
Mm-hmm.
So, especially in things like automobiles.
I guess I mean, do you feel that there's more of a horizon that you can look toward? Before you had cost constraints, you had external pressures such as the oil embargo, and you had political and governmental restraints. Do you feel now a sort of a sense of liberation, sort of opening up for you, in the 90s perhaps, in terms of advanced design?
Well, I think it's a package you have to go for. You just have to keep getting more efficient and do your better job of packaging and tighter. Instruction methods to allow you to do the flush glass and all the things you have to do. Your direction is more set, you know. Where you have to be in general, how you accomplish that is on your own, what way you do that. But it's an even tighter ball game with the Japanese stuff. I don't feel any sense
yes.
of liberation at all.
Really?
Oh,
really
no.
Much tighter, huh?
Oh, yeah. I don't feel any sense of liberation. I feel a sense of urgency and desperation that we get there quick enough with what we're doing, and we
yeah.
do things in less time than we have spent in the past. We're really being shown some unbelievable work processes and attitudes and all that
mm-hmm.
from our friends across the Pacific. And sooner we adopt some of those and beat them at their own game,
mm-hmm.
then I'll feel a little more relief. But I don't feel any relief at all, Dave. None
of course, you scored an end-around play with the Saturn project.
Wow, that's a start.
Start
a good
yeah.
thing.
Yeah.
Right.
Well
that's a program we did working.
Yes,
those
tell me a bit about
we
that.
Did those.
This will be, of course, much advanced. The listening of this, maybe you could tell us some of the details about how that came about.
We frankly, we small car project was stopped in around 82 when we finally realized that we in this country couldn't make that car and sell it for that price and the profit. The project was stopped.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And we quietly knew that eventually something's going to be done. So we started developing some small cars ourselves just to get their foot in the door. And we have developed now not the, the styles, that the car you see running around there is, right, is just a little experimental. It's a mule.
In 85, yeah.
The one you see driving around now in Saturn, of course. But we have the regular models that we have developed there are really handsome cars.
Mm-hmm.
And that whole program is being set in place, you know, and we are, you know, we've already put our majority of our input into it.
Mm-hmm.
There'll be little things that'll change,
right,
as a result, models that are added.
Mm-hmm.
But we have assigned a studio to a particular new young man, as chief designer of that area.
Mm-hmm.
So that'll work out really well.
Do you think that's the shape of the future? Or at least one of the shapes of the future?
Oh, sure, sure. You know, as you go down, the restraints on how much you can change around this particular thing, if it's a four-door sedan with a trunk lid on, you have certain limitations as to what you can do. You say, you know, you don't have to do that. You do anything you want to do, then fine.
Mm-hmm.
But if the restraint is that there's one car like that in the program, you still got to do that one car.
Mm-hmm.
That will be more conservative. Inherently, will end up being more conservative with some other interpretations.
I think Ford seems to be pretty much committed to an aero concept for the next few years. Are you also involved or very much with aero?
Oh, yeah. Ford has been doing more talking about it than we have.
They have been.
Yeah, and their cars and our cars are very close in aero.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I mean, you talk 3-1, 3-2.
Right.
You know, they're very close.